Today on the 21st, high school football teams throughout Illinois started practice this week. They'll be working under new guidelines for managing concussions. Part of the new law involves education.
I think the biggest thing that we have is we're being more educated about it. You know, what actually is a concussion, what actually happens after a concussion.
We'll talk to an expert from the University of Illinois' Beckman Institute about concussion education and his continuing research on head injuries. Plus, the Chicago Cubs and St. Louis Cardinals have the two largest baseball fan bases in central Illinois.
But, you know, from my experiences, the Cubs-Cardinals rivalry has been more of a friendly one that the fans take more enjoyment out of. But this one, the intensity was ratcheted up to where you could say these two teams don't like one another.
We'll hear from a diehard fan from each camp in this rivalry as the Cubs and Cardinals start a four-game series at Wrigley Field today. And with the Illinois State Fair opening this weekend, a look at some of the tasty food offerings that you can recreate at home. I'm Brian Moline in for Nyla Voodoo. That's all coming up on today's 21st. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline sitting in for Nyla Voodoo today. To start, concussions have been a major topic of discussion for professional athletes in recent years, but Illinois lawmakers are making an effort to ensure safety regulations extend to youth programs across the state. Last year, Illinois enacted the Youth Sports Concussion Act, which requires every high school in the state to assign a concussion oversight team to monitor player concussions. The other portion of the law mandates that coaches and trainers take online education courses dealing with concussions. This upcoming season will be the first one with the law in full effect. If you're a parent, coach, or player, and you have a story to share about youth concussions, give us a call at 800-222-9455 or tweet us at 21st Show. We're joined now by Kevin Jackson, who's a senior research scientist at the University of Illinois' Beckman Institute and a former running back for the university. Kevin, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
You've played football. You've suffered concussions yourself. In your experience as a player, what kind of education was available for players and coaches?
I was played a long time ago before they had the new rules that they have in now. So back then, education was pretty much yourself, understanding that if you weren't knocked out, you didn't have a concussion. So having your bell rung was more of, okay, get back in a few plays later, you'll be fine. Now we know that those were mild concussions at that point in time, but we didn't realize that back in those days. But now that they have these understandings that type of hit is actually a concussion, that the player does need to be removed from the play.
In your view, how important is it that everyone involved with youth programs in football especially be educated about concussions and head injuries?
I think it's very important. I think the young mind is very vulnerable at that time. It's still growing and developing. So you want to be able to take the most precautionary measures to make sure the kid is protected. Most kids will probably continue to try to play because they want to have that mentality of going back out there. But it's up to the coaches, players, and parents to also understand that we might need to pull you out for a couple plays or a couple games just to make sure. Because you got to think about, they're still in school, they're still being educated, they're still doing other things. So you don't want to ruin their, you know, high school experience by saying, okay, I'm going to keep playing and damage themselves even more.
Sure. As you're watching particularly young people playing football, what are some warning signs that you can watch for to see if perhaps there is danger of a concussion?
Besides the normal signs, you see a kid being a little lethargic, looks the way he gets up off a play after a play, if he's walking back a certain way. You can tell those clear signs. What I look for when I'm watching a kid is I look at his reaction after a play. How many times does he grab his shoulder? Or does he twitch his hands? Or does he do certain things that aren't normal after a play that I can say? So he may have had some damage, but he's not going to tell anybody. He's just going to keep. And I'll watch him for a couple of plays after that and say, this kid might need to be pulled out. If I was on the sideline, say, hey, we might need to take him out of the game. Some of those signs that you see from the playing the sport that, you know, not grabbing your helmet 12 times after a play really isn't adjusting your helmet. You're trying to get your bearings back, in a sense.
Sure. How often are we learning something new about concussions and head injuries?
Almost every day. It's a learning process because it affects each person differently. So that's the hardest part, is trying to say there's no golden rule in saying this is, you know, we have definitions over and over again for a concussion. But now we're dealing with the other part of dealing with concussion is the subconcussive group that's become more readily available, the repetitive head hits that we don't show a clinical sign of concussion, but we understand, like in boxers, taking a jab and you're perfectly fine, but you know that long-term effect has a damaging template to it.
Sure. When you were playing, how often do you think you and other players were suffering some type of a concussion injury?
I don't think it was concussion. I'd probably say more than one a game or so, if even that, practice-wise. Most times you get them, it'll probably be in the beginning when you first come back preseason. When you're really starting the heavy hitting, you'll start to get some, and then probably some game times. You may have had one or so every other game, if even that.
So when you're looking at some of these physical signs, how do you go about officially diagnosing a concussion or some other type of head injury?
The athletic training staff and the medical staff are very good at doing that, especially here at Illinois. I think that what they do is they clearly understand the players, and I think that's an important part that most people don't understand. You know the players that you're dealing with as athletic and medical staff, that you can see in their eyes, in the way they're talking, the way they behave, that there's something different, and you can just pull them off to the side and say, hey, let's do a quick. They have sideline concussion assessment tools. It's called the SCAT, is one of the tools that they do. So they'll do a preseason baseline to see where the normal levels are before the season starts. And if they do have a concussion or suffer a concussion, they will do a SCAT after that injury to see where their levels are at that point in time and to determine what level before return to play.
You're mentioning a lot about college and some of the protocols that the colleges have in place. Do high school, middle school programs need maybe some more regulation to help monitor concussions and head injuries?
I think they're going around that way with this new law that's just being made. I think that's part of what they're doing now is providing that insight into making sure that the players are protected as well as pulling the players off if they have a concussion. I think they have to sit out for 2 weeks, no questions asked. So it's just a matter of mandating some of these things and make sure they follow through.
We're talking about concussions and head injuries with Kevin Jackson, a senior research scientist at the University of Illinois' Beckman Institute, a former running back for the university as well. You can give us a call if you have a story to share about youth concussions, 800-222-9455, or you can tweet us as well at 21st Show. Kevin, when most people think about concussions, they think about football. That's where there's been the most publicity about those types of injuries. Are we finding that this problem extends beyond the football field into other avenues?
I think that the most thing, like you said, it is mostly focused on football, but I think the most things that people need to understand, a concussion is an injury, no different than if you tore your ACL, if you tore your rotator cuff. It's an injury that we need to pay close attention to. I think as kids who play sports, all of us have played, we fell off our bike before. If you bumped your head into a cabinet and saw small stars or something, that's a mild concussion. So you need to pay attention that it's not just the sporting thing, that it can happen in other avenues of your life. Car accidents happen all the time. So those are the things that people need to understand. It's not a sport injury, but it is an actual injury itself that can happen in other walks of life.
Sure. So not just on the sporting field, but whatever you happen to be doing, it can pop up wherever.
Right. And I think that's the consensus. It's hard to diagnose and you think of the general population, because most of the time if you bump your head on the cabinet, you're not going to the doctor. So a lot of those are underreported into the hospital setting or reported to us, because you don't go, you know, you don't, if you fall off your bike, you don't go tell your mom, my mom fell off the bike. You just go continue playing as a kid. So those are some of the things that we have to educate more about, this understanding that it's not just a sport thing, that it is an actual thing that could happen as far as an injury itself.
Let's talk a little bit about the research you've done here at the University of Illinois. What are some areas that you're really focusing on in your work at the Beckman Institute?
Part of the first project that we started was looking at ways of dealing with post-concussion aspects of things and being able to treat, not say treat concussion, but be able to alleviate some of the symptoms post-concussion. One of the projects that I work with the neurosurgeon over at Carl, Dr. John Wong, is looking at ways to deal with cooling after a head injury. A lot of things that we talk about in sporting events, we look at the concussion itself, but nobody ever talks about temperature. As you know, if you play a sport, your body gets hot, your temperature is elevated. Research has shown that the elevated temperature makes the pathology of the disease a little bit worse. So if we can actually deal with taking the heat away, maybe your brain can start dealing with some of the other aspects of dealing with the injury itself. So a part we were trying to do is use a cooling device that we have, a cooling helmet that we have, is applying it immediately afterwards in a sporting event. When you think about general population concussions, the thing that you think about is most of the time you don't go to the hospital, and you usually take 2 or 3 days before you say, all right, something's wrong, I'm going to go get checked out. Where in the athletic world, we can see it happening right there on the spot, and we can actually get to treating it and doing something about it. Most times, most things they would do is put a kid in a dark room, take away all the stimulus around them, and then put a cold ice pack on the back of the neck. So all we're doing is alleviating that. You've seen in boxers between rounds that they put ice on the back of the neck to try to alleviate some of the heat stress aspects of body temperature.
Sure. How did you become interested in this line of research?
It's a long line. I became interested in it because when I started working for Dr. Wong, it was more of a animal project we were interested in, understanding cooling effects of the brain. And when I saw the cooling helmet, they were using it for military purpose and understanding blast injuries that happen. And can we use a certain device to be able to provide frontline surgeons that by the time they get back to the triage unit, it would be 3 or 4 hours later that this cooling device could be running that whole time. So when I saw the helmet itself, I got, well, that'd be interesting to use it for the sporting world. So that's where it took off from there.
Sure. And I guess about your path, an interesting path for you from college football player to where you're at now. How did that line come about?
Oh, it was a long line. my interest has always been in science. As a little kid, both my mom and my sister had complications from diabetes. So when I got a chance to get a college scholarship, I was interested in science. So I ended up working. I actually have my bachelor's and master's and PhD all are in animal science. With a background in reproductive physiology. And over the last 6 years, I've been working more on the brain because a lot of the stuff that we do now is most focused on that. But my track record for doing certain things has always been science. I've always been interested in that aspect.
Very good. Let's, I guess, talk about severity of concussion injuries a little bit. How can you tell when you're trying to diagnose there on site, whether you're talking about mild concussion, more moderate, more severe? What are some ways to tell about differences in degree?
It's kind of hard to tell at first. Obviously, knowing, the medical staff, our team doctors or things will look at a person. If you were knocked out, we already know that there's obviously still a mild, but, loss of consciousness depends on how long those symptoms last after the injury. Could be a part of, severity of the injury itself. What you want to do if it's a severe aspect, you want to try to get them to the hospital and get a brain check to make sure there's no skull fractures, anything of that nature, and to make sure. But the severity is kind of hard to tell on the sideline immediately. I mean, taking a kid back, trying to make sure there's no brain bleeds, but making sure that the kid is aware of what's going on and how, how well he's responding back to you is ways and signs of telling how severe the aspect is.
Sure. What would you say maybe the most important thing is for people to understand about concussions as, we're learning new things almost every day? What's maybe the most important thing for people to keep in mind if they're, whether they're a parent, a player, a coach?
That it is a real injury, that, you really need to pay attention to your bearings. I'm not saying every concussion or every mild concussion that you're dealing with has to be severely watched, but understanding that, okay, I did have this mild traumatic disruption in my brain function. What do I want to do? What do I need to do to make sure this doesn't continue to happen? I think that's the most important part. And it's not just a football thing. And I think a lot of parents are saying, I don't want my kid to play football, but you can have it in soccer. You can have it in other sports. I think of race car driving, bull riders, cheerleading. You have all these different aspects that people are saying it's only a football disease. Well, it really isn't. It's a disease that can affect any sport. I mean, it's an injury that can affect any sport.
Sure. What are maybe some ways to minimize the chances of head injury, whether it's in football or anywhere else? Is it something along the lines of reducing some of the contact in practice? What are some ways to maybe go about doing that?
And I think that's you're right on the target with that. I think that's what they've been doing. A lot of teams are backing off from more hitting contacts, where it's more just helmets and pads, no pads, and getting the players used to that aspect. I think in the Ivy League, they banned tackling down to the ground. They do still wear shells, which is just the shoulder pads and helmets, but they don't do any live tackling throughout the season, which is more game time situation. So I think that's one of the things of trying to deal with taking that repetitive head hits aspects out of the game.
Sure. Is there any kind of a textbook definition you could give us for exactly what is a concussion?
It's about 15 different versions I can give you. just a disturbance in the brain that causes you to think something happened in that momentary, whether it's loss of consciousness or not, that you still had a disturbance. Like I said, bumping your head to the side of the cabinet, we've all done it. But that mild, you see some small stars or something like that. We may have not have thought of that as a concussion, but that is a mild concussion. So understanding that what levels that there is.
I think you might have touched on this a little bit earlier, but I think it might be worth mentioning again. You know, the new law that the IHSA passed is focused on middle school and high school athletic programs. Are kids at those ages at a little greater risk for damage from concussions?
At that still time, you're still growing and developing, so you don't want to make sure at that age that that brain is still developing the proper way, and having those type of damages or injury can prolong the recovery of the kid getting back. So you do want to take the precautionary measures to make sure the kid is being properly evaluated and being looked at, not only by the medical staff, but also being watched out by the coaches and the parents itself.
What's your relationship been like with the training staff here at the University of Illinois and kind of working on some of your research here?
I think it's been very good. I think the biggest part that working with the medical staff as well as the athletic training staff here is that I understand where they're coming from, being around it most of my life, and understand the demands is on them. You know, they have a lot to deal with. It's not just one player that they have to deal with. They're dealing with multiples at the same time. And understanding, trying to watch all these players at some time, so you have to get to understand the moods and attitudes of each one of these players. I think that's where the biggest trust is built between a player and the medical staff and athletic training staff, because you see them every day. You're around them every day. So you can get a better sense of something's not right about that kid. When something happens on a hard play, you can say, I might want to pull them out as an athletic training staff or medical staff.
Very good. Kevin Jackson, senior research scientist at the University of Illinois' Beckman Institute, former running back for the University of Illinois as well. Kevin, thank you very much for joining us today on the 21st.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
First is made possible by the library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, supporting librarianship and the training of librarians, instructing instructors as they embed the library into classrooms and beyond the campus across the globe. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. The longstanding rivalry between the Chicago Cubs and the St. Louis Cardinals hasn't always had a heated history, but it may have been pushed over the edge after the two teams met in last year's playoffs for the first time.
You know, from my experiences, the Cubs-Cardinals rivalry has been more of a friendly one that the fans take more enjoyment out of. But this one, the intensity was ratcheted up to where you could say these two teams don't like one another.
I think those days are over. I think this is a heated rivalry. I think you're going to see it for years to come.
That's an MLB Network panel discussing the Cubs and Cardinals. There might not be any place the rivalry has been stronger than here in Central Illinois, smack dab in between St. Louis and Chicago. The two Major League Baseball teams are playing each other in a four-game series this weekend, and we're joined now by two sports writers who aren't afraid to hide their fandom for each team. In the red corner, Will Leach is an outspoken Cardinals fan and the founding editor of the popular sports blog Deadspin.com. He currently writes about sports for the website Sports on Earth. Will Leach, welcome to the 21st.
Of course. Thanks for having me, Brian.
And in the blue corner, Brett Taylor is a Chicago Cubs bleacher bum who started Bleacher Nation, a popular Cubs blog. Brett, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Will, you've usually had the upper hand in these conversations, but not this year. What's happening with the Cardinals so far this season?
Yeah, it's been a frustrating season, to say the least. You know, I think the Cubs, obviously what they kind of did in the division series last year, I think kind of laid down the gauntlet that they were coming, but the Cardinals were not able to not only not match the Cubs, but really have not been able to not match kind of their own history of success this year. It's been a difficult year. a lot of issues. There's been some injury issues, but really, you know, this is a team the Cardinals have always kind of been like founded on, like solid baseball, base running, and good defense and low scoring. Like the whole idea was the Cubs were building their franchise on power, and the Cardinals were pitching their franchise on pitching and defense. This year, the defense in particular has been a total mess. So it's been a very disappointing season for the Cardinals. It's still worth noting that they, even at this moment, heading into the series, they are actually still tied for the second wild card spot, which I feel obliged to point out is what the Cubs had going into the playoffs.
Sure. Brett, over to you. The Cubs have not won the World Series in over a century, and all-season Cubs fans have seemed to be looking over their shoulder a little bit for something to go wrong. What's the feeling like with the Cubs fans right now? They've got a 12-game lead in the division on a 9-game winning streak.
Yeah, I mean, anytime you're talking about the Cubs in recent history, looking back at a 12-game lead over the Cardinals in mid-August, there's something about that that just feels unreal. And I think it's very hard for fans to accept the sort of probabilities that we're seeing out there in terms of the Cubs' odds of winning this division. And heck, the last time these two teams played at Wrigley, the Cardinals ultimately swept the Cubs. So, you know, it's not as if the distance between the teams in terms of talent and success is necessarily that far. In fact, I'll even start this off on a cordial foot and point out that the Cardinals have been among the most unlucky teams in terms of sequencing and sort of the things that determine wins and losses that aren't necessarily reflective of talent. So they've had some tough luck this year. But certainly I don't think there were many Cubs fans that, although we expected the team to be very good this year, I don't know that we would have expected quite the gap to have emerged in the standings at this point in the season.
Sure, and Will, back to you. I'm curious how serious this rivalry is for you as a diehard fan. Does it rank high on the list of sports rivalries for you?
Oh, I mean, it's the top of my list. I'm from Mattoon. So, you know, we are, as you know, kind of as you go up, I have friends in St. Louis who don't understand why they consider the Cubs rivals. And I have friends in the Cubs who don't consider why they consider the Cardinals rivals. But you come in the middle and all of a sudden those percentages start getting to 50-50. So I feel like I am in the, where I was from, you know, I mean, Mattoon, everybody's Illini fans, but some people are Cardinals fans and some people are Cubs fans. So you kind of have to live together in a lot of ways. So, but of course, you know, I grew up with those great 80s Cardinals teams, but let's not forget there were some pretty terrific Cubs teams in that time. Jody Davis haunted my dreams as a child. That was like a very exciting Cubs team during that era. So yeah, I think that the Cardinals have had more success over the last, well, insert the number of years that you'd like to insert in that number. They've had that success for a long period of time. The idea that the Cubs have always been just this beaten down, step on their neck franchise, you know, I just don't think that's true. Even when the Cardinals and Cubs, the Cardinals have been a lot better than the Cubs, it always felt that series against the Cubs, even when they were in this rebuilding period, building up to now, those games were always a lot tougher against the Cardinals than the Cubs seem to play against other teams. So I feel like that rivalry has always been a little heated, even when there's been an imbalance in the standings.
Sure. And Brett, how about for you, the Cubs-Cardinals rivalry?
Well, I think for a lot of self-critical thinking Cubs fans over the past 30 years, particularly the last 15 or so, a lot of the antipathy for the Cardinals and the sense of rivalry comes from a feeling like no matter what happens to that organization, they're always there. They always find a way to continue this level of success and finding players. And we always sort of joke about the Cardinals' voodoo magic, but ultimately what it is just a really well-constructed organization with a lot of ability to keep churning out players from a system that you might not otherwise see that success coming. And so I think for Cubs fans, it has always felt like in the sporadic years in the past when the Cubs were competitive, the Cardinals were always right there. And so there was still that feeling of intensity in the rivalry, even though over a long enough time horizon, the competitiveness was mostly one-sided. And so, but I definitely agree with Will that even in the years when the Cubs weren't competitive, fans, you know, we still got up for those Cardinals series. It makes sports more enjoyable, frankly, when particularly if your team isn't in playoff contention, you want to have something to be excited about, you want to have a villain, you want to be into it in that way. And so some of the best series over the years have actually come in years when the Cubs were just kind of trying to be the spoiler.
And Brett, do you feel like the rivalry has even ratcheted up more here in the past year or so?
Well, I definitely think there's been a sense now that Cardinals fans are aware of what the horizon looks like for the Cubs to perhaps be successful for a while. And I think that does kind of increase the intensity on a series by series basis, because it's not a one-off thing. And so I think that you could say that probably has ratcheted up a bit. But to be honest, you know, most of my interactions with Cardinal fans, maybe much to the chagrin of my Cubs fan brethren out there, for the most part, they're just good baseball fans. And I've been actually pleasantly surprised when I've gone to Cardinal series the last 2 years at Wrigley. They've mostly been very pleasant.
And Will, for you, have you felt like the Cubs Cardinals rivalry has gotten a boost here the last year? The playoff series meeting last year, the Cubs signing a couple of players away from the Cardinals in the offseason, has that kind of boosted the rivalry in your view?
Yeah, though I certainly agree with the notion that, you know, I lived in New York for 13 years. I saw the Yankees Red Sox rivalry. Those fans legitimately hate one another and legitimately want to hurt one another. I've never seen that when it comes to, I went to a Yankees Red Sox playoff series where I just saw like this Yankees fan just randomly punch a Red Sox fan who wasn't even looking at him, just wearing a Red Sox hat. I've never seen that in the Cardinals Cubs series. I do feel like, you know, one of the great things about it, about this rivalry, is these are two jewel baseball franchises. Like these are teams that both travel well. They have fans all across the country, and I think because of that, it leads to the spirited rivalry, even when teams aren't that great. But I also think that it leads to, like, a Cardinal fan, you can't look at the Cubs and say nobody cares about the Cubs, even when the Cubs weren't good. People have always cared about the Cubs, and I think because of that, you respect a rival like that a little bit more. And certainly, I think what's really stepped it up, to be entirely honest, is that the Cubs have kind of beaten the Cardinals around the head and neck for the last 10 months now. I mean, starting with that series, you know, the Cardinals won 100 games last year. That was a very excellent Cardinals team, and I will be, as a Cardinals fan, will have nightmares of fly balls going over the Cardinals right fielder's head and the wall for many years to come. So I think what's ratcheted up the rivalry is not only the teams are good at the same time, but the Cubs have really just owned the Cardinals really ever since that series. And not just with that series, but then taking Hayward. I think the Cubs have Hayward hasn't had a great year, but I think it's still – He's still someone the Cardinals wanted to keep, and the Cubs are not unhappy with. And then to be able to get to have this like 12-game lead now, it's hard to argue. I find myself as a Cardinal fan doing something that I don't usually like to do, which is, hey, 11 championships, how about that? And that makes me feel like a Yankees fan, and I do not like that.
I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the defining moments of the rivalry over the years. For me, my first memory and the lasting memory of this rivalry was in 1984, a nationally televised game between the Cubs and Cardinals on NBC, where Ryne Sandberg hit two home runs off of Cardinals reliever Bruce Sutter. It was a game that the Cubs went on to win in 11 innings and, of course, went on to their first playoff berth in 39 years that season. By the way, if our listeners have a story to share, give us a call at 800-222-9455, or you can tweet us as well at 21st Show. Brett, I'll start with you. What's kind of a defining moment of the Cubs-Cardinals rivalry for you?
Man, is it a total cop out if I'm pointing to the divisional series last year?
No,
I mean, you know, it's, you're talking about the first time these teams have met in the postseason, and although it's of course very recent, I think that it's going to be one of those series, particularly for Cubs fans, and perhaps maybe in a haunting sense for Cardinals fans. It's going to be a series that we're going to remember for a very, very long time. Of course, these iconic moments. You've got Javi Baez bringing Cubs back. You've got, of course, Kyle Schwarber hitting the top of the scoreboard. It's something that's going to stick with us, and I think the Cubs fan hope certainly is that maybe it's we look at it 10 years from now as a turning point where the Cubs kind of pulled even with the Cardinals and being one of these annually competitive, consistently churning out quality players organizations.
Will, how about for you, a defining moment in Cubs-Cardinals?
I will say that thought that he had about that being a pivot for the Cubs taking over the Cardinals spot is exactly what the Cardinals fans thought when they were watching that game. I feel like we've kind of heading uphill against history in that. Yeah, you know, I think it's hard to argue that the biggest moment is frankly not that divisional series last year, because the Cardinals really have not had that opportunity. The Cardinals, there was that stretch over that 15-year stretch where the Cardinals only missed the playoffs by four seasons, but those are the four seasons that the Cubs made the playoffs. Like, they've just always missed each other in the playoffs. Like, sure, I can bring out great moments like Albert Pujols' famous hit three homers against the Cubs at Wrigley Field in 2004 during that great, great Cardinals team that is still the best Cardinals team of my lifetime, was that 04 team. Well, I will always remember that, but that was – you know, that wasn't a great Cubs team. Of course, to me, I'm also of the age where, I'm sorry if you want me to feel bad about the greatness of the Mark McGwire, Sammy Sosa home run chase. I will not feel bad about it. Those were really, that was a great experience to be able to watch. To me, that kind of embodied what I like about the Cardinals Cubs rivalry was not just that they were going at each other, but at the end of the game, they hugged each other and they were all, and it was kind of a warmth and a general kind of understanding, well, still commiseration, almost a Midwestern commiseration in the midst of this very competitive thing that was going on. I always think of that as the thing that I love the most about the rivalry. But as a full Cardinals ticket to the Cubs, yeah, this makes me happy. There's been enough of those that none necessarily stand out, which I think makes that division series last year stand out even more.
Sure. Just a couple of tweets from listeners that we've had here today. Scott simply says his favorite memory of the rivalry is the Cardinals holding the upper hand for most of his life. Meanwhile, John lets us know he remembers a game in 1989 where Luis Salazar, who was acquired in a trade, tripled to score Andre Dawson in a game against the Cardinals. That year, of course, the Cubs went on to win the National League Eastern Division. Back to this season for a moment, Brett. Right now, the Cubs have that 12-game lead in the Central Division. How important do you think this weekend's series is to maybe, finish off the Cardinals here for this season?
Probably not very, which again, I'm bringing the lame non-hot takes pretty rapidly. But, you know, I think back to the series that preceded the Cubs' really dramatic fall in July of this year that it's almost hard to remember at this point now that they're 30 games over 500 again, but the Cubs were swept by the Cardinals at Wrigley. There were some very winnable games in that series that they were not able to put together at the end. And then the Cubs kind of fell off for quite a while. And yet here we are a month later, and the Cubs are back up 12 games. And I think this is just such an incredibly deep, talented Cubs team that I think it would take a lot more than even, heaven forbid, a four-game series sweep this weekend by the Cardinals to really reverse the trajectory of this team in terms of winning the NL Central. And so I think more, you know, if you want to put some emotional weight into it, I highly doubt this Cubs team would want to lose seven in a row to the Cardinals and sort of allow those thoughts to creep in about, okay, are we really better than the Cardinals this year? And I think that's probably about as far as you could take it. And otherwise, it's just a matter of racking up wins and creating that distance to try and lock up the division as early as possible and rest guys down the stretch.
Will, from your perspective, the series this weekend, a 12-game division lead, probably not something the Cardinals can overcome, but in terms of just trying to scrape their way into the playoffs, how important is this weekend series for the Cardinals?
Well, one thing that's a little frustrating, it was really only late to July, July 26th, 27th, that the Cardinals had a chance to get within like 5.5 games. And again, 5.5 games is still a substantial margin, but with that, you were looking at this series wondering, okay, maybe you can get it down to 5 or 6 and take 3 out of 4 and start making inroads. And then the Cubs took off a 1-9 in a row, and the Cardinals couldn't beat the Reds or the Braves. So I think that's why we're sitting here talking like a wild card. Really, when it comes to the Cardinals, the Cubs are, and what's interesting about this particular series, this series was always seen as a time when the Cardinals would maybe make some of the roster moves that they've actually made this week. We've seen Alex Reyes, their kind of flamethrowing top prospect who is going to be pitching the eighth inning but will eventually be a starter. We saw him at the Futures games. He's one of the most highly rated prospects in baseball. The Cardinals are now you always knew he was going to be here by this series. And I think Luke Weaver, another one of their top prospects, will be starting on Saturday. The Cardinals clearly saw this series, whether or not they're going to be able to catch the Cubs. The Cardinals still, even with their struggles to win the second wild card, consider themselves a championship contender. And when you are a championship contender, you want to measure yourself against the best team in baseball, and that team has been the Cubs. So I think whether or not this matters in the NL Central, I don't think it will at all. It certainly matters for the Cardinals need to like get back on track after a very difficult 2 weeks and measure them and really kind of get the focus that they've lacked a lot of this season. The Cubs are a good way to try to get that back going.
And Will, last question, just a couple of seconds left here. When we get to October, are the Cardinals in the playoffs?
I have to say, if they weren't fighting with any teams other than the Marlins or the Mets, who I think are also deeply flawed teams, I still think the Cardinals have the most talent. The question is whether they can get out of their own way and take that spot. I will say yes. And then erase this if it doesn't happen.
And Brett, just a couple of seconds here. Is this the year?
I always beg off when I get that question. I mean, I think This is certainly one of the most talented teams the Cubs have had, at least certainly since 2008. And of course, that team got swept right out of the playoffs, and so we know how that can go in those short series. But I think they're well built. They'll be there, and you know, maybe hopefully they don't see the Cardinals in the playoffs.
Brett Taylor, Will Leach, thank you very much for joining us on the 21st.
Thanks.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. Over the next week, thousands of people will make the trip to Springfield for music, carnival rides, ag shows, harness races, and a lot more. Tonight's the unofficial opening of the Illinois State Fair. It all starts with the Twilight Parade at 5:30 p.m. And, of course, many people come out to the fair for the food. Pork chops on a stick, roasted nuts, and fried, well, everything. We know not everybody can make it to the fair, but that doesn't mean you have to miss out on the food. Taste of Home compiled a list of 18 recipes to make state fair food at home. Taste of Home editor James Shend joins us now by phone. James, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you very much.
When it comes to which foods you find at fairs, how much does it depend on the state you're in?
A lot of it does. I mean, each state has their own peculiar quirks and things like that that they like to showcase. Like I know the Wisconsin State Fair is very much focused on cream puffs or anything in the dairy world. I know Texas is like the beef like haven for anything you would want. So it all depends on where you are.
Sure. And what are some of the staples that you tend to find no matter where you go?
Anything on a stick. That seems to be a common theme throughout every single state fair. It's like, what can we stick on a stick? And but you do usually have your corn dogs. You do have burgers and wings and things like that. Those are pretty common, along with a good funnel cake. You can't go without having a good funnel cake.
What in your mind makes for really good fair food?
Well, what I have seen in the past is where you get the most creativity in the food is at the fair. I mean, they tend to come up with some very unusual things. They're all usually very, very tasty, and then they're always usually easy to eat on the go. So a lot of handheld things, a lot of things you can take with you or take out of the park when you're leaving.
Does fair food have to be necessarily, it gets a bad rap sometimes, but does it have to be unhealthy?
It doesn't really. You do see most of the foods at the fair are usually deep fried, just because that is an easy way to cook it. You just normally see that. But there are people that are starting to bring in more healthy options there. You can also look at some of the foods that are typically deep fried, like you were mentioning the pork chop on a stick. And it's like, well, if it is, then just kind of scrape off a lot of that outside coating, which honestly is the really tasty part. And you've lost a good amount of that deep frying fat. So you're then left with a fairly lean pork chop.
Sure. How difficult is it to recreate that fair food effect at home?
It's actually very, very easy. As you mentioned, we have 18 recipes that we pulled together that are very typical of state fair foods. One of our favorites is a bacon-wrapped corn. We first saw this at the Wisconsin State Fair, and we took it off a stick. But you just wrap a single slice of bacon around an ear of corn, little chili powder on there, wrap it in foil, and then toss it on the grill for a while. And one of our other favorites that one of our readers found was pizza on a stick. And she recreated that just by cooking up some turkey sausage. You could use just regular Italian sausage. and then skewering it onto metal skewers with cherry tomatoes, mushrooms, onions, this and that. And then she wrapped a commercial pizza dough around that and tossed it in the oven. And it cooks up beautifully, and kids love that. And then she used the turkey sausage just to kind of bring the fat and calories down.
Sure.
And then an icon of the Texas State Fair is a walking taco, or what they call a Frito pie, where they just open up a small bag of Fritos, dump in chili and beans and cheese and stuff, hand you a fork, and away you go. And honestly, that's one of my favorite things.
Sure. Another one that's always popular here in the Midwest, your recipe that you run through is for Indiana-style corn dogs. How easy is that one to recreate?
That one is pretty easy if you're not timid about deep frying. And people used to do this a lot, and I think people are getting away from it, but it's a very easy technique to do. You just kind of have to keep an eye on the oil. The coating itself is just a mixture of flour, cornmeal, a little baking powder, and then you just stick a skewer in a hot dog, dip it in the batter, and then away you go.
Sure. And you can't go to a fair without getting the giant turkey legs, of course. You've got a recipe there for hot and spicy turkey legs. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the hot and spicy turkey legs is something that we just put up not too long ago. And what you do is you just marinate the turkey legs in a mixture of hot sauce, a little soy sauce, some chili powder, mustard, garlic powder, things like that, some good seasonings to it, and let it sit overnight. A good 8 hours is probably the minimum that you want to do. Then you can toss them in the oven about 375. I've also put them onto the grill and then just grilled them that way. You just kind of have to keep an eye on them because it does take a little bit of time to cook. And on a grill, you kind of have to kind of watch that and just monitor the heat. But it's real easy, especially if you do it in the oven.
Sure. Just curious, James, do you personally make and taste all of these recipes with your staff at Taste at Home?
I do. I have a rough job here. We have two tastings a day, and we're going to taste between 9 and 12 recipes a day.
And as an aside, how do you do that and not gain just a huge amount of weight?
There is a lot of good gym time. but you also realize this isn't lunch. This isn't a feeding. It's a tasting. And we're going to look at the food, and we're going to analyze what the flavor is, how it looks, are people going to be able to recreate this easy, and does it have legs? Because this is going to live on our website for many, many, many years. So people can go to tastethehome.com and find this stuff and know that the recipes will work. So we do run every single recipe that we publish, whether it's in our magazine, on our website, is going through the test kitchen. And it is tested many times before we are comfortable to put it up there. So we are very comfortable knowing that the recipes do work.
Sure. You mentioned that a staple in Wisconsin is the cream puff. It's one that, on the surface, to me at least, as a novice baker, looks like it could be a little bit tricky to recreate. Tell us a little bit about the recipe you've come up with for cream puffs.
Well, the cream puff is, like you said, it is it's got a bad rap because it does look very difficult to do, and it's actually one of the most easy things you can do because it basically is foolproof. You just mix eggs and butter and flour in a saucepan until it just kind of, you keep mixing the heck out of it until it pulls away from the side of the pan, and then you just start piping it onto or dolloping it onto a baking sheet. When it goes in the oven, all that butter and eggs will start to expand it. And it creates this beautiful puff shell that you can do anything with. It doesn't have to actually stay as a dessert. Wisconsin is known for filling it with a sweetened whipped cream, but I also see in the Illinois State Fair that one of your vendors is doing a barbecue parfait, or it's not a barbecue parfait, but they're taking the cream puff and they're filling it with pulled pork. And I'm like, that is an awesome way to do this because it does show that there is a way to take what is typically seen as a dessert and move it over into the savory side of things. So you can fill that thing with anything. I mean, I've done like a seafood gumbo. I've just poured that in as a kind of like a bread bowl. And then people just go crazy over it. But it's something that's very, very easy. It may take like one or two times to kind of get those little quirks down, but it's an easy thing to do.
Sure. Another staple here in the Midwest, and actually a representative from Illinois on your website, is the recipe for baked elephant ears. That one sounds tasty.
Baked elephant ears, that is our healthy play for something that is ridiculously fatty and oh so good. But that one, it's a yeast dough, and people also are a little bit nervous about doing the yeast dough, but it's very, very easy to do. Just follow the instructions, and you just need to build in a little bit of time. So you just mix all the ingredients up with the yeast, the water, the flour, sugar, and let it rise. And so stick it off in the corner and just let it do its thing for about an hour or two. And then you roll it out, spread it with a mixture of butter, sugar, and cinnamon, roll it up, and then you're basically just baking it. You slice and bake. So it's something very easy to do, and you can actually make them ahead of time and freeze them.
Very good. And there's so many great pie recipes out there. How did you go about choosing the recipes for this State Fair food post?
Well, we talked to a lot of people on our staff, and because we have people from all over the country, but we also have a number of people on our Facebook page that we reach out to and just talk to, what are you seeing at your state fair? And so they started suggesting things. And some people from Michigan and Door County here in Wisconsin are like, cherry. We need cherry pies. People in Washington, caramel apples are the thing. We had some seafood recipes. So it was just we tried to look at everything across the country and come up with a good representation of what you'd find just kind of cruising through all of them. And it's a hard thing to do because, like, I'm at the Wisconsin State Fair last week, and then there was 93 foods on a stick. So I'm like, there's a lot of things that you can cover with that. Unfortunately, most of them are deep fried.
Speaking of deep fried, the one that I have yet to try, but I see being represented more and more, is a deep fried candy bar. Why would you deep fry a candy bar?
Oh, you obviously haven't had one. how to describe this? The candy bar kind of gets soft and melty and gooey. Last year I had a deep fried Snickers bar at the fair, and the caramel gets really hot and oozes out, and the chocolate is a mess, and you need a couple of wet wipes after you're done. But it is something that you need to try, whether it's a Snickers bar, a Milky Way. I've heard that the latest one now is deep fried peanut butter cups. And so I'm like, all right, got to go do that one.
Sounds like this might be your favorite food on the list.
Yeah, it would be right up there, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think my absolute favorite is the bacon-wrapped corn, which is the one I started with.
All right, very good. James Shend, Taste of Home editor, telling us all about some recipes for State Fair food that you can recreate in your own home. Thank you very much, James, for talking with us today.
Hey, it's my pleasure, and you guys have fun at the State Fair.
Thanks a lot. As we mentioned, the Illinois State Fair gets started tonight. That runs through August 21st. Another major draw at the fair, of course, is the live music stages each night. This year's Illinois State Fair will be headlined by Pat Benatar, Kiss, Meghan Trainor, and more. We'll give you a little taste right now. Here's a classic from ZZ Top, who's closing out the State Fair on the 21st. This is LaGrange.
Rumors spread around, United takes his time, about to check outside the game. And you know what I'm talking about, just let me know if you're gonna go to that whole mile on the range. They got a lot of nice girls. I'm racing. Well, here it's fine if you got.
That's all the time we have for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Just search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links and every other way to contact us via phone, email, or social media is at our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Christine Herman, Philip Kisabika, Sean Newman, and Travis Stancil, with assistance from Ben Thomas Payne. Our technical direction comes from Jason Croft, with help today from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our news director. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.